I'm John Kroll. When an earthquake shook Nepal in April of last year, three Hoosiers were on site to see the horror and devastation that followed, and they found ways to help. John Mead, Dave Carter, and Ashiaki were in Nepal looking at Mount Everest when the ground rumbled. We will talk with them today about what they saw, felt, and did during and after the disaster. If you would like to join the conversation, please call 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. And track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about the 2015 Nepal earthquake. Three Hoosiers were on site there. We're going to hear their story. They're actually going to be the earthquake itself is going to be the focus of a Nova program that is going to be premiering tomorrow night on the television side of WFYI. We're going to talk with them about what they saw, what they experienced, and how it felt to be at the scene of that disaster. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are the three folks who were there. We're going to talk with them about why they were there. They are John Mead, who is an attorney here in Indianapolis, Dave Carter of ProBuild, known for decades as Carter Lee Lumber, and Ashiaki of the Lilly Endowment. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Welcome, John.
It's good to have all three of you here. So I'm going to ask first about the circumstances that brought you to be there. I'm sure you're not the equivalent of the tornado chasers or anything like that. You obviously did not go out looking for an earthquake here. What brought you to be on site? And I'll start with whoever wants to start the conversation.
We were on a trek, and the goal was to get to Everest Base Camp. And I've been to Nepal 10 times, and the April trip was my 10th trip. And I usually go to Nepal about every other year, and I try to take a group of people from Indianapolis to Nepal because it's a great place, and you find wisdom when you go there. But an average trek to Everest Base Camp is door-to-door from Indianapolis between 18 to 21 days. Mm-hmm. And we were, I believe it was about day 8 into our trek towards Everest Base Camp, and it was April 25th. We were around 16,500 feet above sea level, and we had just had lunch at a village called Dugla, and Dugla is basically just two small little structures, and we had fried rice, and we stepped out the door to start hiking closer to Everest Base Camp, and about 11:55, I remember putting my right foot down on a rock, and I started feeling dizzy, and I thought that I was possibly getting sick or had food poisoning or something. And but I looked around and I noticed that everybody else in the group was basically kind of going back and forth, and I realized we were in an earthquake, and I think all of us were kind of shocked at first. And the earthquake lasted for about 45 seconds, and it was a 7.8. And we were in a whiteout. We had low visibility. There was snow flurries. And so you really couldn't see anything around where we were. I knew we were a safe area from avalanches and landslides because we were in a big valley. And the valley was about a mile wide. But you couldn't see anything, but you could hear these massive rock slides happening. And so the earthquake went 45 seconds, and when it ended, we just kind of all looked at each other, and I had never been in a major earthquake. Nobody from Indianapolis had, and one of our guys that was on the trip was from California, And we asked John, was that a big earthquake? And he said, yeah, I think it was about a 6.0. And we just kind of, oh, wow. Then we kept on hiking. Mm-hmm. And there were some smaller aftershocks. And we hiked for another hour and a half. And we got to a village called Lobache. And Lobache is around 17,000 feet. And when we were about 100 yards from Lobache, I remember looking into the village. And at that point, I realized it was a major earthquake because you could see some of the buildings had collapsed or partially collapsed. And at that point, we kind of realized, okay, we've been in a major, major earthquake. And we thankfully were lucky enough to get a real quick Wi-Fi when we were there mm-hmm. from the one of the tea houses. And we sent out, John Mead sent out a post on Facebook that we'd been in an earthquake and that we were safe, and which we really weren't, and that we were kind of reevaluating everything and seeing what the next step was going to be.
John, Ace, was this your first time in Nepal, or had you been there before?
This was my second time. I'd been once before in 2010.
Okay. Ace, how about you?
This was my first trip to Nepal.
Okay. And I've got to think, because it sounds like you were in a fairly remote area, that there had to be some fear involved, too, that you see this and think, oh, this maybe this isn't the safest place on Earth to be right now. John, Ace, either one of you?
Well, I'm not sure my initial reaction was fear. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've been fortunate to climb lots of different mountains around the world, and I've actually felt like I've been in kind of sketchier situations before when the earthquake hit. As Dave said, we were moved back and forth a good, it seemed like, 3 to 5 feet side to side during that 45 seconds. But we knew we were in this open area, and even though we could hear the rock slide and avalanches coming down, we knew they weren't going to hit us. So I think, you know, I just felt a little bit, I felt safe. It wasn't until probably days later that I, trekking back down and all of the aftershocks and maybe even that first night that we ran out of our tea house, I think 3 or 4 times because of the aftershocks, is when I really realized we're in a major situation. You know, I always felt like we were going to get back. I just didn't know when we were going to get back, probably. I think that was probably the biggest thing for me.
What was it like, John, seeing the you know, it sounds like when you approached that second village and saw really that you know, structures, buildings had been brought down and all of that, that this was a much more serious situation than you initially had realized. What was that like?
Yeah, that's really when it starts to dawn on you, because during the quake itself, as Dave and Ace said, you know, we were standing there and you can feel it moving, but you don't really have anything to judge it by. So as we continued on our hike, we passed some hikers coming down the trail, and you start to get rumor that, oh, it's horrible, it's terrible, but you don't really know. The word on the trail is notoriously unreliable.
Mm-hmm.
We'd heard several times that all the bridges were out, that Namche Bazaar, this large village, was completely isolated, and you know, all the bridges were fine. Namche was closed but still standing. So you don't really know until we arrived up at Lobache and you actually see physical damage to these buildings, where the construction up there is largely stacked stone within wood framing inside. Mm-hmm. And with a lot of the buildings, the earthquake caused the stone facings to fall.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, fortunately, they would fall outwards, mm-hmm. but and be left with the wood structure inside. But you know, there were several buildings that collapsed completely. The tea house that we were staying in was a three-story building, and one of the outside walls on it, the stone had collapsed from top to bottom in one section. We were staying on a back wing, but it certainly didn't inspire confidence. I mean, during the earthquake itself, I don't know that I felt fear or anything like that. It was just such a completely new experience. You certainly got very uneasy and frightened when you're in a building, because you didn't know when the next earthquake was going to come. You didn't know what was going to happen to the earth, to the building that you were in. So we got in the habit of any time we went into a new building, whether it was for lunch or for overnight, that we would locate all of our exits.
We like would, they tell you on the airplane.
Exactly. And we'd designate a rally point. So this, if we have to bug out, here's where we're going to meet. And I know that first night we all packed go bags. Mm-hmm. You had a bag with your water, your medicines, and anything that you needed immediately ready to go, slept with our boots on.
Oh, boy. And you say that night, you know, that first night, because of the aftershocks, you had to flee the place where you were sleeping three or four times?
Yeah, I think that's right.
And, you know, I mean, that had to be... I'm guessing that there probably wasn't a whole lot of sleeping then that went on.
Not after that first one.
Slept with one eye open most of the night.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you are just joining us, we're talking about the Nepal earthquake of last year with three people who experienced it, all of them from Indiana, John Mead, Dave Carter, and Ace Yakey. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So it sounds like, at least immediately, you sort of continued with the hike and the expedition, right, Dave?
Well, right after the earthquake, and we arrived at Lobashe around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were kind of unpacking and getting settled in and trying to figure out what had just happened and how bad it was. And we did have some internet news from the BBC saying that Kathmandu was devastated. And at that point, we really didn't realize what had happened at Everest Base Camp. There was a significant avalanche that was caused by the earthquake, and that killed 18 people and basically wiped out Everest Base Camp. And it wasn't until about 6 in the evening, it was getting dark, we were kind of standing outside of the lodge because nobody really wanted to go into the lodge because it was dangerous, quite frankly. And a lot of the Sherpas, we started seeing a bunch of Sherpas coming down the mountain, basically really moving fast down the mountain. Nobody was talking, and at that point we realized that there was a major issue at base camp.
And were you able to communicate with them at all or figure out, you know, the scope of it? Because in some ways this sounds like, in a very tragic sense, this is almost like a detective story here where you have to figure out what has happened and the scope of it as you're going along. Dave, John, either one of you.
Well, I think several of the Sherpas that we were trekking with, our guides, were talking with some of the folks coming down the mountain. And as you see walking wounded, you get the picture that something very bad happened at base camp other than just an earthquake.
And how long did it take for you really to sort of wrap? I mean, this was a huge, devastating experience for everyone. How long did it take for you to really wrap your head around the fact that, oh, okay, this is something really, really large?
Ace? No, I'm not sure. I'll just speak for myself, but I know how some of the other guys feel. I'm not sure you ever wrap your head around it.
Yeah.
This far out from it. You still think about it. It's still part of your psyche to have been through that kind of an experience, lived through it, and seen the devastation that it causes, and then leave and know that you're leaving that devastation behind. I think that's something that really stays with you.
At what point did you leave?
We left about, I believe it was about 8 days after the earthquake. And, You know, you have to understand, you know, Nepal is an isolated country. There aren't any roads outside of Kathmandu, and you're on trails the whole way.
So you're getting out even after you've made the decision to do so is not an effortless process.
In and
of itself. Well, we're going to talk, once we get to the other side of the break, about, you know, what you decided to do after experiencing this disaster in that magnitude. If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Nepal earthquake of last year. My guests are John Mead, Dave Carter, and H. Yakey, all of whom experienced it and were hiking there at the time. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today with three Hoosiers who were at the scene of the 2015 Nepal earthquake. They are John Mead, who's an Indianapolis attorney, Dave Carter of ProBuild, known for decades as Carter Lee Lumber, and H. Yakey of the Lilly Endowment. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. And I should say, if you would like to experience more of the Nepal earthquake of last year, there is a NOVA special that will be appearing on WFYI Channel 20 tomorrow night at 9 p.m. called Himalayan Megaquake. We would encourage you to tune in. Well, before we went to the break, we were talking about sort of the process of departing Nepal after this, that it was about 8 days after the earthquake. How did you spend the 8 days from the moment the earth shook until you got on the plane to go back? Ace, I'm going to start with you.
Sure, John. Well, it was, I think it took us 4 days, maybe five, to get back down to Lukla, which is where the airstrip is that most expeditions, trekkers, fly into and then begin their trek from that point. Because we were so high on the mountain when the earthquake hit, we were about, 4 hours below base camp. There were quite a few trekkers and climbers and Sherpas that had made their way into Lukla by the time we got there. So there's a single airstrip, and flights were delayed. Some people had been there for 4 or 5 days, the amount of time it took us to get back down to Lukla. So when we got there, we sort of cooled our heels for 2 days before we were able to get a flight back into Kathmandu.
And how did at that point, were you in contact with the rest of the world? I mean, was sort of the scope of the devastation becoming more apparent to you as putting a statistical face on what you were seeing, basically, John?
We were getting better information by that point. We actually ran into some Green Berets who had been activated by the U.S. Embassy or by the State Department. They had been doing some high altitude or high elevation training in the area. And so when the earthquake hit, the State Department pulled them into their service. There were two guys in Lukla who were taking a census of all the Americans in the area, just trying to get a head count and check people off versus, you know, known lists of trekkers and climbers in the area. One of the benefits of having them there is they had their own satellite dish. So we had some free Wi-Fi and could make telephone calls once we were back in Lukla.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with three Hoosiers who were at the scene of the 2015 Nepal earthquake. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named David has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Hi.
You guys sort of answered my question already. I was going to ask, how many days were you really out of touch with civilization? But I guess you said about eight. But I guess another question for me then, the trek back, the 4 or 5 days it took you to reach the airstrip, how did you guys just have the supplies with you from when you were on the mountain, or did you guys just have to go on, like, limited rations, or what happened for those 4 or 5 days, really?
Thanks very much. Great question, David. Thanks for the call.
Dave, that's a good question. There are tea houses, what they call tea houses, in these villages all up and down the route to Everest Base Camp, and they're owned by Sherpas. And a lot of those tea houses are, you know, they're bunk rooms and they have eating facilities, and they're well stocked with rice and lentils and, you know, eggs and potatoes, especially before this trekking season starts. And there was plenty of food up and down the Khumbu Valley to handle all the trekkers last year. And so on the way down from Everest Base Camp area, we had plenty of supplies and plenty of food and clean water. We probably were in a better position up in the Khumbu Valley where the Everest is compared to the people down in Kathmandu. We had more resources available to us at the time, so we really didn't have to worry about food and water or anything like that, any shortages.
You've said that the fear, any fear you experienced, was more a retroactive experience than it was a current one. But could you walk me through, we've sort of traced the physical journey here, but this is a cataclysmic event. I mean, people were dying, and the suffering was immense, and if you're not in the exact center of it, you're in the same zip code, definitely. What was it like for you? And I want to hear from all three of you on this. When you began to see just how devastating this was for the people who lived there. I'm going to start with John first.
I think for myself, I wasn't that concerned about myself.
Yeah.
I felt pretty contained. I knew that in our group we had two doctors from Indianapolis, Chuck Hasbrook and Mike Myers. We had a nurse with us, and Dave, of course, is a trained EMT. But one of the first things that we did that first night in Lobiche is we sat down with our Sherpas. We had four guides with us, and then two other Sherpas who were running the yaks that were carrying our baggage. And we said, look, this has been obviously a devastating earthquake. You have families, you have homes that you need to get to. And we said, you know, we've been here before. Dave has been there before many times. I'd been there. Tim Keppel had been there. So mm-hmm. we felt comfortable enough in our own selves, you know, contained, that we said, go take care of your families, go see to your homes. And they wouldn't. They said, no, our job is to get you out of here safely. And
was it a sense of professional commitment to them, or what motivated? Because for most of us, I think the minute somebody says, go take care of your family in a situation like that, you're going to go.
Yeah, I would assume it's professional commitment on their part. I would also guess that they did have some communications from their families, and they did know the extent, because they were on their cell phones pretty extensively. Very fortunate to have cell coverage up through that valley. But you know, in hindsight, we were very fortunate that they did stay with us, because even coming down the valley, some of the villages, the first one down from Lobiche, a village called Ferriche, had been hit particularly hard A lot of the buildings were damaged and collapsed. All of the lodges at the time that we got there were closed.
Mm-hmm.
And with some work on the ground from our Sherpa team and probably a well-placed call from the owner of our trekking company, Wong Chu Sherpa, one opened and took us in and fed us and housed us that night. So we were very fortunate in that extent.
Dave, walk me through your emotional journey.
First of all, I wanted to get everybody out of there in one piece. And the third night after the earthquake, we were in a village called Namche Bazaar. And, you know, we're experiencing aftershocks every few hours. Some you can feel and some you know are happening because you just know. But and that evening when we went to bed, it started raining, and it started raining, a significant amount of rain. And at that point that evening, my mountaineer instinct kicked in, and I was very concerned about landslides, because what had happened is the earthquake had loosened up the topsoil and large boulders, and the rain was going to lube that up.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern was landslides, big rock falls. And Namche is in the middle of a valley, and it's kind of right in the middle of a runnel area. And I was concerned the mountain would give way and take part of the area out. So that was probably the first time that I had some real sense of fear that we really needed to get out of here as fast as possible. And hiking into Namche that day, there had been a landslide that had taken out 10 yaks above the village, and we walked through that just after it happened, and we really didn't realize what had happened until we got back down to Namche. And that was kind of like, to me, that was the eye-opening experience of the trip, that there's some danger here still. We need to, you know, get out of this valley with a lot of rocks that are over our heads that can fall, and all that stuff is loosened from the earthquake.
Ace?
You know, I would agree with Dave in the sense that when we got to Namche Bazaar, I was able to, that was the first time I was able to get in touch with my wife. And I think when I spoke with home, if you will, mm-hmm. is when I realized that I was in a faraway place. There was, as David indicated, there was still a lot of imminent danger. We didn't know from hour to hour when the next aftershock would be. We ran out of our tea house in Namche at dinner and one or two more times maybe that night. And I think just being able to communicate at home made me realize how far away from home I was. I would also like to say that, you know, all of us have been in, on big mountains doing lots mm-hmm. of adventure trekking and climbing. So it's not that we don't know that these kinds of things can happen. And so you sort of, I won't say you become numb to them, but you acknowledge that they exist and you live within that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't begin to tell you, since this was my first time to Nepal, how friendly and caring and loving the Sherpas and Nepalese people are. Their major concern, their only concern, was for our safety and our welfare. And even though I know that's a professional commitment on their part,
mm-hmm.
you knew that it was genuine. And we now have friends back there that we feel connected to. And that's the reason for our efforts back here to help them.
And that's I wanted to pivot to that because obviously you work in the world of philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
So at some level there is the person who is just having the experience mm-hmm. there. But given the kind of work you do, there also had to have been a second eye looking at things and thinking, oh, maybe there is a way we can help here, or there are ways we can help. When did that part of your brain kick in?
Yeah, I think all of us probably thought about that pretty early on. It started to coalesce for me, when we got back to Kathmandu, I was having some conversations with a couple of the group. And, you know, we got back to Indianapolis, and we immediately went about kind of an initial, let's help our Sherpas and their families as much as we can. The monsoons were coming at the end of May. We knew that their homes, many of their homes had been destroyed in Chiangba. And so we sort of passed the hat, raised a few thousand dollars pretty quickly, and filled, 40-some duffel bags full of donated solar lanterns, tarps, and tents, and medical supplies. And Dave and another person who's been over there before and his son flew those supplies back and that cash back and got that in the hands of our Sherpas. So we felt good about doing something that was short-term, that was immediate, but we also knew that we wanted to do something longer-term. And I think that's when the three of us, especially back in Indianapolis, said, you know, there's more that we can do. We're fortunate. Let's really make something happen that where we can go back and raise significant amount of money and help rebuild schools and medical facilities and water projects that have been destroyed back in Nepal to help not only our Sherpas but others.
How did that conversation start? I mean, you say it was back here in Indianapolis. The three of you together.
It was probably over a beer.
Over a beer,
I guess.
That's okay. That's a time-honored custom. It seems to work for a lot of us. So, but you know, were you getting together to sort of relive the experience, to revisit it, or
I think
put me in that scene.
I think a piece of it was certainly that. I know. I didn't sleep real well for quite a few weeks, kept waking up. I think the other Dave and John had similar experiences. When you go through an experience like that, it's important to share it and talk about it with those that experienced it with you. So I think part of our getting together was certainly, maybe we didn't rationalize it that way, but medicinal. It was probably helpful, and I think out of that grew our not only our respect for the Sherpas and the people that we left behind. Leaving the airport in Kathmandu was really hard for me, knowing that we were leaving behind so much destruction, and that in a short period of time we would be back here where, you know, nothing really happened.
Living in considerable material comfort and
exactly
and all of that. I should ask, because I want to explore how you settled on the plan to help and all of that. But I'm curious just what you were saying. Were the three of you close friends before you went through this experience?
Yeah, we all were. And then there was three other guys from Indianapolis, Dr. Chuck Hasbrook and Dr. Mike Meyer and then Glenn Moling. And, you know, so we all... You know, there were six of us, and we all talked about we need to do something more long term. And you have to understand there were 2.8 million people in Nepal that were displaced. 8,000 schools were completely destroyed, and over 1 million kids were schoolless from the earthquake. And that was kind of what we worked off of, knowing that there was a bigger plan for us to do something to try to help long term.
And as I say, I do want to get into that, but I'm just kind of curious about having been through a searing experience like that. Did it deepen your friendship?
I think so.
Sure.
Yeah.
Has to.
Absolutely.
Sure.
So, I mean, and the other part of this that's at the personal level that I think is fascinating, you say all three of you had trouble sleeping after you came back. What were you thinking about, I mean, when you woke up at the middle of the night, John? I've only given you a few seconds to answer this, I realize, but...
Did the building just move?
Oh, so there was still a feeling of instability or insecurity that followed you after that. If you are just joining us, we are talking about the 2015 Nepal earthquake with three people who experienced it, all of them from Indianapolis, John Meade, Dave Carter, and Ace Yakey. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the 2015 Nepal earthquake with three men who were there and experienced it, all of them from Indianapolis. They are John Mead, who's an Indianapolis attorney, Dave Carter of ProBuild, known for decades as Carter Lee Lumber, and Ace Yakey of the Lilly Endowment. Before we went to the break, we were talking about the process by which you guys had arrived at a commitment to try to help and the scope of the help that needed to be provided here. You know, 2.8 million people, I think it was 8,000 schools demolished, a million students without school, who were schoolless for a while. So talk to me about what you decided to do about all of this. I'll start with Ace.
Well, I think we knew we needed to do something that was long-term but also sustainable. And there's always a tension between wanting to do something immediately, the tug, the emotional, and doing the right thing. And so, as we said a little bit earlier, we did something immediately, which we thought would be helpful right away. And that gave us some time then to think about the long term. And we wanted to make sure that we were doing the help that we could provide was not just the help that we wanted to provide, but it was help that was needed and that was wanted. And so I'll let Dave Carter talk about his connection and our involvement with David Brashears, but that became sort of a central piece for us. David Brashears has worked and spent an enormous amount of time in Nepal over the years as a professional guide and filmmaker, cinematographer, and we knew that if we could, he would be a tremendous draw for our fundraising if we could get him to Indianapolis. So we sort of leaned on John Mead with the Economic Club and David with his relationship with David Brashears and said, man, if we could get him here to do a fundraiser for us and then speak at the Economic Club, it'd be sort of a 1-2 punch. He's a very famous mountaineer in person and would be a big draw for us. So that was our plan to entice folks to want to come to support the effort. I talked with John Herbst at the Indiana Historical Society, and he and his board were generous enough to donate the auditorium free of charge for us. We had other vendors that provided food and drink, so we kept our costs at a very minimum. We went to a group called TechPoint, Mike Langelier, and they have an internship program. None of us are tech savvy at all, but we knew if we had some young millennials on our team, they'd be able to create a Facebook page for us, create a website, do all the kinds of things that we couldn't do. I can't thank them enough for the work they did. They met with us numerous times, and then a group of about six young interns developed our entire promotional plan and set everything up for us. So we had an event on Monday evening at the Indiana Historical Society where David Brashears did a presentation and did slides about Nepal and the earthquake. And then through our Facebook page and some direct emails and mail that we sent out to our contact lists, we're now at about, we've raised just a tick under $100,000. And now we're doing the proper planning to see where we can make that first investment and make sure that our donors feel and know that we're spending their funds responsibly and making good long-term investments to help the people of Nepal.
What is your goal? I mean, your fundraising goal for this? I'm assuming it's more. You say you've done the first 100,000. That implies that there are more to come.
Well, yeah. And that's also a question we've been talking about. $100,000 in Nepal goes a very, very long ways. We can do a lot of good with that amount of money, but we're also thinking that there's enough interest that we might keep this going and do sort of, you know, annual maybe updates and fundraisers to replenish the funds. We haven't spent any of the funds yet. In fact, the three of us drove to Grand Rapids, Michigan last Saturday, met with a Sherpa up there and another gentleman who operates a nonprofit educational organization. And we think our first investment will be to help rebuild a school in Chiangba, which is the village where our Sherpas were from.
And, you know, you've raised the $100,000. Is there a place, if people who are listening to this want to make a contribution, that they can do so?
Dave? Yeah, we have the fund is right now, it's at the Central Indiana Community Foundation, and it's called the Nepal Relief Fund. And they can get on the Central Indiana Community Foundation website and do a direct donation and just say that the money is for the Nepal Relief Fund. And we also have a Facebook page where you can go to. It's the Nepal Relief Fund Indy, and you can get on that and do a donation through that.
And I should say, on our Facebook page here at No Limits, there is a link to it, and we're going to be sending a tweet out too.
So with
that. So if you folks who are listening, if you do feel moved to make a contribution, if you cannot navigate the CICF site or find it on Facebook, you're used to coming to our page, just go through there and the money will get to the folks. So your inclination is to do the school first. Where are some of the other needs that are critical there, John?
Well, we think in addition to schools, which regardless of the earthquake, schools would be an area that needs assistance in Nepal. But in addition to schools as a result of the earthquake, we've also targeted medical clinics and water systems. In a lot of these rural villages, they don't have a water source nearby, so a lot of the local labor is spent walking to and from water sources carrying jugs of water. I know Dave and some other folks were involved in funding and planning a water project for this village, Chiangba, previously, and it had some pretty dramatic effects. We don't know if causation necessarily relates to correlation or vice versa, but since the water project was installed, the number of miscarriages had drastically dropped.
Dave, you said this was your 10th visit to Nepal, and from what I understand, earlier you also had a near-death experience too, right? On Everest, I guess I have to ask, what keeps pulling you back?
The people of Nepal are fabulous people. First of all, the country is so beautiful. I mean, looking at the mountains, the glaciers, and going through the monasteries as you walk into Everest Base Camp, it's just an incredible experience. But as Ace and John and I have been saying, it's really not the mountains, it's the people that make the place special. And the Sherpa people especially are, you know, the only way I can describe these guys, you know, they're the type of people that you want in a foxhole next to you when it's getting bad. And, you know, when we were coming down off the mountain after this earthquake, they formed a protective bubble around us, basically. And that's why I keep coming back to Nepal. I just love the people. And I also like pushing myself physically and mentally in the mountains. And, you know, it's the only time I don't think about work when I'm in Nepal. Man, I'm sure a lot of people can say that. But it's when you go to Nepal, you find wisdom. You understand what most of the world is like. You know, you understand the effects of climate change, you know, poorly governed countries. You know, it all kind of comes together in Nepal, and you learn a lot.
Well, I'm assuming that, you know, we're now 9 months or so past the earthquake, but it sounds like you're all in touch with people who are from the country who are there, right? What are they telling you that, and I probably should preface this, have any of the three of you been back since then?
Yeah, I went back with Jay Miller and Carter Miller in June, right after the earthquake, with all of our relief supplies that our group from India had raised. And we delivered all these supplies plus $8,000 in cash, and the Sherpas bought tin roofing with that money for the villages. So going back was hard. One, there was still aftershocks, and two, just looking at the damage, it's incredible. And you have to understand this village of Chiangba, about every house in Chiangba was severely structurally damaged or totally destroyed. And the school was totally destroyed. And those kids have been in school in tents since the earthquake. And you have to understand that village is at 8,500 vertical feet above sea level. And they've been through a monsoon and they've been through winter. And they're still going to school in tents. And nothing has been built yet because of the Nepalese government, for one, has not allowed anything to be built because they're working on specifications for new schools right now. That has not been released. And we're waiting on that to get released before our money gets released to help rebuild these schools.
That has to be frustrating.
Very frustrating.
That you raise the money, you're ready there to stand there and help, and there's not really a way to do that just yet. We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Randy, and if you'd like to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. You can send us an email at nolimits@WFYI.org or give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Randy asked the question, basically, are there other ways besides donating that people can help?
Sure. Go to Nepal.
Go to Nepal.
Support the country. I don't know, huge amount of their economy is driven by the tourism and climbing and trekking business, which then supports all of the tea houses and along the trail. So go back and see the wonderful people. If you've never been there, go, and there are wonderful trekking trails and routes to take. See Kathmandu. There are, in Kathmandu, three World Heritage Sites. There's just tremendous beauty and culture to experience in Nepal.
We are talking about the Nepal earthquake of April 2015 here on No Limits. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Actually, I was able to go out to the Everest Base Camp trek, but it sounds like these guys were on the same route through Lukla to Everest Base Camp. And I went out in October, so just 6 months after the earthquake. So I was able to see some of the rebuilding efforts that were going on, and curious to get these guys' thoughts on some of those limitations that you may be facing in terms of dealing with local governments and how you're working around that with your donations to get the buildings back put together.
Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Thank you,
Michael. Well, that is a good question, because obviously it sounds like that's sort of the dam point there, that the money is ready to flow, and presumably there are people who are ready to do the work there too. It's how do you get the government at some level to get out of the way?
That's a very complicated question, and it's a great question.
It generally is with government, even ours. But
and,
yeah.
You know, one thing with our fund is we have identified certain people in certain groups in Nepal that we trust, and the easiest first project for us is going to be Chiangba, because we know most of the Sherpas that live in that village, and we know the leaders of that village, and so we will identify those guys to be responsible for our funds to build this school, knowing that we're going to be going back there too. But there's a lot of things going on with the Nepalese government. Most of the funds that have been sent over there, the government funds, there's been, I believe, maybe $2 billion that has been sent over there so far. And most of those funds have not been spent yet on any type of rebuilding efforts. And the government in Nepal is not a, I call it an extractive government. And it's not really there for the purpose to help the people out, the way I look at it. And so you have to be very careful that our funds can hopefully go around the government handlers.
Do they expect to siphon off some? Is what you're trying to say is that there are patterns of institutionalized corruption there?
No doubt. That's the problem. And that's one reason why we haven't done anything yet. We're trying to figure out what I would call the chain of custody in this, and making sure we're comfortable with it. And like I said earlier, the government is issuing specifications for schools in Nepal and how they're supposed to be built, and we haven't seen those yet. And once those are out, hopefully we can move forward with our project.
John.
Yeah, and one thing I think further complicating the matter beyond the Nepalese government is the Indian government. They've basically imposed a blockade on Nepal's southern border. You know, Nepal is landlocked. It's surrounded on one side by India, on the other side by Tibet/China. And the Indian government is not particularly happy with the changes proposed for the constitution in Nepal, and they've instituted an informal, and I'm sure it's denied, blockade. And so the ability to get materials and fuel is very limited. There's one road into Nepal from China and more roads from India, but there's nothing coming across.
Let's assume that these obstacles, man-made obstacles, clearly get removed. Do the three of you plan to go back and help with the work of that first school? Ace, John?
Sure. I think it's all of our goal to not only be part of the planning and implementation and, if you will, being an investor with the rest of our wonderful donors who have contributed to the fund, but all of us would like to go back and see firsthand how those dollars are being helpful, and also see the people that we left behind.
If you could, in say just a sentence, how did being part of this experience change you? We'll start with Ace. Again, just a sentence, please.
You know, it changed my life. I've been around the world, but this was an experience that drew me closer to knowing that the world is a very small place, and we need to be present with all of it.
John.
It certainly makes you very aware of the first world life that we live, and how close to the edge or over the edge so many people out there are.
Dave, you got about 15 seconds.
You know, we're all interconnected in this world, and actions that the United States does or that I do personally influences other places in the world.
Thank you all. It's been fascinating listening to you. And I would like to thank our listeners as well. We will be back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about hate crimes legislation. I'm John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.